Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the heads of two of the state's largest biomedical organizations, Vertex Pharmaceuticals and Partners Healthcare, they'll talk to us about the impacts President Trump's proposed budget could have on Massachusetts. Also today, a Massachusetts criminal case asks if sending texts encouraging someone to commit suicide is the same as helping that person take their own life.
From July 6th to July 12th, she asked Conrad in excess of 40 times when he was going to kill himself.
Plus, Washington is responding to that story about the leaked NSA documents and a Russian hack on a U.S. voting software company. Here's Senator Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri.
We spend a lot of time in this country talking about voter ID. Imagine the disruption if thousands of people showed up to vote and their names were no longer on the voter files.
We'll get reaction from the NSA's own former inspector general. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start today with two top leaders in one of the state's most important sectors. David Torchiana is president of and CEO of Partners Healthcare, the state's largest hospital network, which includes some 6,000 physicians at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Mass General, North Shore Medical Center, and more. Partners' 2016 operating revenue topped $12.5 billion. Dr. Torchiana, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Jeffrey Leiden. He's chairman, president, and CEO of Vertex Pharmaceuticals, maker of multiple drugs for cystic fibrosis and other diseases. Vertex's current market cap, more than $32 billion. Dr. Leiden, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meg. It's wonderful to be here.
So, I mean, I gave those revenue and market cap figures to give people a sense as to, you know, how large and important the organizations that you represent are to the biomedical ecosystem here in Massachusetts. And it's a delight to have both of you in the studio. I've been looking forward to talking to the two of you for quite a while. But we brought you in here because not that long ago you co-authored an op-ed where you talked about the health of research and biomedical research in Massachusetts. And you wrote that the strength of our biomedical ecosystem matters. The cost of not investing is clear. So did you feel compelled to write that in response to President Trump's budget, which proposes reducing funding for the NIH by almost $6 billion?
You know, I think we wrote it because it's a critical time for this biomedical ecosystem. We have been successful in America for the last 50 years and really led the world. We're the envy of the world in terms of new breakthrough drugs produced, patents produced, and jobs created. And we stand on the threshold of a time where there's even more opportunity for serious diseases like cancer and Alzheimer's. But to make sure we recognize that opportunity, it's more important than ever that we provide funding for the NIH that does all of the basic science research that leads to these new treatments.
So I guess maybe another way for me to ask it, and Dr. Torchiana, I'll turn this one to you. I mean, are you concerned that that funding may not be forthcoming with the current administration?
Well, the administration has made its position clear with its budget proposal reducing NIH funding by 20%. I have a reasonably high level of confidence that there's historically been bipartisan support in Congress to not go down that path. So I think that there's lots of concern. I think that part of the concern is it reflects an indifference to the importance of science. And one of the reasons why we felt it would be helpful to discuss these issues with the administration was to emphasize the multiple dimensions of biomedicine, including the very significant economic benefit that it has for this country and for this country's position in a world marketplace. So it's not a great start. If you start with a 20% cut, you feel good getting back to zero or something close. But I remain optimistic that we'll fund these Very important areas because they matter so much.
Yeah. So you mentioned discussing these issues with the administration. I want to come back to that in just mm-hmm. a moment. But this, let me just ask it as let me put it yet another way. You were very careful in this op-ed to not specifically call out the Trump administration or the president. I mean, why not? It is his proposed budget.
It's very early days, Meg, in this process. We're in the discussion and debate phase, and we wanted to add our voices to that discussion and debate. As you know, we were both down at the White House as well discussing it with them, and I think our feeling was they're very much in listening mode. So I think we wanted to make sure that those points of view were heard by everyone.
So can you tell us, I mean, who in the administration you met with in your White House meetings and more on the nature of the discussions?
Well, I think the nature of the discussion, the perspective that certainly Secretary Price and I think the president and his advisors have is that there is waste in every level of government. So presumably there's room to cut virtually any government budget. And then secondly, that there's an opportunity for the private sector to intervene and make up some of the funding gap if that were to occur, particularly if the private sector and the government were to share in the return of invention and commercialization. The final thing, there's an esoteric part of scientific funding called indirect cost. Mm-hmm. And I think the government looks at NIH indirect cost payments and feels like they're overpaying for the infrastructure that supports research. So they have a perspective. It's the perspective that you would expect from a business leader in a business-oriented administration. And for better or for worse, I don't know that calling people out when you're trying to have a dialogue and reach a constructive end accomplishes a heck of a lot.
Okay.
I think yeah. One of the most important points we made to Torch's point was that these different parts of the ecosystem, the NIH, academia, biotech, they aren't actually interchangeable. What the NIH and academia do is absolutely irreplaceable. And so cuts in NIH funding can't simply be made up for by what the private sector is going to do. And I think there was a lot of appreciation at that point during our discussion.
We should note that it doesn't seem as if Congress is likely to take up the president's proposed budget cuts on NIH in any meaningful way. And in fact, earlier this year, Congress ignored part of the proposal to slice $1.2 billion for the NIH for the next fiscal year, and instead actually awarded the agency some extra money, an extra $2 billion. So it's sort of a, you know, what's really going on here? I mean, what can you read from the different branches of government approaching this in different ways? Are we alarmed over nothing?
No, I don't think it's nothing. Okay. I think this is definitely a serious discussion that's going on. On the other hand, as you point out, I think many in Congress for a long time have understood the importance of the NIH, supported the NIH, and we certainly saw that last year. We just want to make sure that continues.
And I guess I'd add the local feature, since this is for local consumption, this is particularly critical for Massachusetts, which is, I think, why Jeff and I felt the need to write the op-ed piece.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit, because we were looking at some numbers, and Dr. Torchiana, since you're the head of partners, MGH, Mass General, is the largest recipient of NIH grants in Massachusetts, or amongst the largest. Last year, the hospital received some $365 million in NIH funding. So, I mean, so what potential effect could any cut have on MGH or partners as a whole?
Well, I'd blow it up a little bit. So one of the very unique things about Massachusetts is that about 60% of the NIH funding actually goes to hospitals in Massachusetts. Around the rest of the country, virtually all goes to universities. Mm-hmm. So Massachusetts has an unusual structure, and we actually have many of the highest funding levels of independent hospitals in the country. I think we have 8 out of the top 14, and MGH is number one on the list. Partners actually in aggregate, including the Brigham and Spalding and McLean, is the largest institutional recipient of NIH funds in the country. The other thing that I would add is that the other Boston teaching hospitals would all be major research centers in their own right in other cities. So Boston is absolutely a unique concentration of basic research And that's why this economy and the ecology has grown up around it so powerfully in the last 15 years. And that's the thing that I think is at risk. And it's at risk from multiple directions, one of which is NIH funding. The other is the health of the hospitals has an awful lot to do with the health of the research enterprise.
I mean, so but tell me more specifically, like if NIH funding were cut in a meaningful way, I mean, what practical impact might that have on partners?
Well, I think the two things that are most immediate is obviously we would have less funding to support research, so we would have to consolidate and diminish our workforce and reduce the amount of activity that we had. I think the two most significant long-term impacts would be, and this one I think is the strongest, is the impact on trainees and the future of the field, because it's already pretty tough to get your first NIH grant. People typically don't get their first R01 till their early 40s, and the bar for getting a grant awarded is at about the 20% level, so it's very competitive. So a very negative effect on the pipeline, very negative effect on the current enterprise. And then I think the final piece, which is a bit more intangible, but maybe just as important as any of the others, is it would have a very significant effect on the economic spinoff of the work that gets done, because companies like Jeff's they take basic science and they turn it into products and cures. But you need the basic science, and the only place the basic science comes from is from NIH.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why there is this synergistic effect in terms of who we have here in Massachusetts. Dr. Lido, I mean, let me just put it to you directly, too. So can you tell us what the practical impacts on a company like Vertex might be?
Yeah, I think they're exactly the two that Torch mentioned. First of all, we rely on the hospitals and universities for our future workforce. That's where these folks get trained. And so if training goes down, and it certainly would if there were major cuts to the NIH, it affects directly our ability to get the best and the brightest out of our local universities. But the second one is the entire biomedical economy has grown up because of the proximity of the NIH-funded work that's going on at the hospitals and universities to us. And just to give you a couple of numbers, there are more than 400 biotechs right here in Massachusetts today, more than $2 billion a year of venture capital invested, more than 65,000 jobs. And so the future of that industry, which today looks so bright, would be threatened by these kinds of cuts.
What would you say to maybe some people who are a little skeptical, and for the very reason that the two of you run two very big, large, important organizations in Massachusetts? I mean, I did put those numbers out there about Partners 2016 revenue being over $12 billion, and we also looked up Vertex's market cap at above $30 billion, and we see it's the best performing stock on the S&P 500 this year, I guess, or at least one of the best. Point being that there are a lot of folks out there who might say Partners and Vertex don't really have anything to worry about regardless of what happens with NIH funding, because you know, you're big. You have your own resources.
Yeah, I'm most concerned about a couple other things. First of all, I've been involved in the startup part of this economy for a long time. There's 50 to 80 new startups that form here every year, and they won't form with these kinds of cuts because that comes directly out. The other thing I'm really concerned about is patients. I mean, at the end of the day, we all do what we do to make new treatments, breakthrough treatments for patients. And to slow that down now for diseases like cancer and Alzheimer's, to me, would be a real shame.
Just want to circle back in the last couple of minutes that we had to something that you mentioned, Dr. Torchione, a little bit earlier about Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price talking about indirect costs of research, utilities, internet service, data storage, that kind of thing. And it seems like the secretary sees that as one place where there could be some belt tightening. Because I wonder, does that have anything to do with, a process that Partners seems to be going through right now, something called Partners 2.0, a multi-year initiative that's going to optimize efficiencies at Partners?
I wouldn't connect the two dots. I'll answer your question in a sec. But about a quarter of that total that you cited is devoted to research on our campus. And by far the major piece of indirect cost is space. So space is the most expensive component in supporting a broad basic science program. Partners 2.0 has a research component, but it's basically responding to the pressures on costs that all healthcare systems are facing around the country. And we're trying to make sure that we're lined up and organized as efficiently as we can so that we're making efficient uses of the resources that we have.
I mean, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like kind of a significant endeavor that Partners is going through. $600 million?
$600 million, which is obviously about a 5% piece of our expense base. So it looks a little more manageable when you think of it in those terms. I've been in this business for quite a while, and this is something that you recurrently have to do in any organization, but particularly in healthcare, where there's always a good new opportunity to make an investment in addressing an unmet need. And intermittently, you have to step back and look at your structure and make sure you don't have a lot of duplication and overlap, and you're not doing a lot of things that are less effective than they could be. And because we're big and we have lots of moving parts, we have a big opportunity, I think, to do better here.
I mean, you're a huge employer in terms of human capital, right?
We're the largest employer in the outside state. Of state government in the state.
And it was just in April that Partners offered buyouts for, what, 1,600 workers at Brigham and Women's Hospital? Are there more buyouts on the way?
Well, I think there are certainly more personnel moves on the way in the future. As you said, we have 73,000 employees. We actually hire and turn over about 8,000 employees a year, so there's a lot of in and out. And I hope that whatever we are able to accomplish over the next few years will mostly be accomplished through managing that. But when you look at hospital systems, particularly 70% of our costs are in people. So you can't manage your costs without managing your people.
I appreciate you engaging with me on these questions. But as you'll also appreciate, a lot of our listeners are likely employees for both of you.
Certainly some of them are.
So Dr. David Torchiana, President and CEO of Partners Healthcare, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Jeffrey Leiden, Chairman, President, and CEO of Vertex Pharmaceuticals, my thanks to you as well.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks, Mike.
And we have a link to their op-ed that's at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Opening statements today in a trial involving two teenagers, texting, and suicide. Michelle Carter was 17 years old when she allegedly encouraged her friend, 18-year-old Conrad Roy, to kill himself. The central question in this case? She did it by text messages. So are those text messages the same as helping someone kill himself? WBUR's David Boeri has been following this case and joins us now. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, what did prosecutors say in opening arguments today?
Prosecutors cannot seem to read enough of those texts to the court, Meghna. They did that again today, portraying Michelle Carter, someone who was coaxing, pushing, berating, mocking, and practically ordering her social texting partner from 30 miles away to get back in the truck where the fumes of carbon monoxide were building, which was poisoning him and caused him to step out of the truck. She told him, get back in the truck. Here's some of the texts that were presented to the court from Michelle Carter. The time is right and you're ready. Just do it, babe. Another one. When are you going to do it? She shows frustration seemingly in those texts. Another one. You promise? To which he says, I promise, babe. To which she says, he adds, I have to now. And then she reminds him, you can't break your promise. 40 times or more, she was suggesting that her boyfriend, her social texting partner, Conrad Roy, kill himself.
Wow. And some of those text messages even go into specific detail about how he should do it, David. I mean, what was the defense's opening argument, you know, in defense of her?
Well, the defense is arguing. This is sad. It's tragic. It's a suicide. It's not a homicide. That Michelle Carter didn't cause his death. It was caused by carbon monoxide poisoning, that he had a long track record leading up to this suicide, a number of attempts before. And it, you know, what's fascinating is there's this, I fell into it. The prosecution calls them boyfriend, girlfriend. The defense says they're not boyfriend, girlfriend. They're social texting partners. In a way, it made them even closer because these texts, Magda, are just graphic. They're intimate, and it's all about how you kill yourself.
Mm. Now, David, just remind us, what specifically is Carter being charged with again?
Well, Carter's being charged with manslaughter.
Yeah. Okay.
And so this is the heart of it, is whether or not, and some would say this is a push, the defense certainly says that, whether or not she can be held responsible for what Conrad Roy did to himself that day.
Yeah. And I just ask because I just want to be clear for people who don't know the details of the case. She is not charged at all with physically aiding him in any way, right?
Oh, but not physically aiding him. I think the prosecution would say she put him in the truck. She badgered him into doing this. She practically ordered. She gave the weight of this. And it's interesting because this has had a run-up before this trial.
Right.
There were a number of appeals because her defense attorney did not want charges brought. So it went to the Supreme Judicial Court. And there was a ruling there upholding the lower judge, who said there was probable cause, that her, in quoting here, admonishment, pressure, and instructions caused him to get back in the truck. And that's the truck that had those carbon monoxide fumes from a machine that was going on inside. And he got back in and he died.
Right. So you're quoting Justice Robert Cordry from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court there. I mean, so it's interesting, even to have this case, the SJC had to rule about whether or not there was enough evidence or reason to do so.
Judge.
Yeah.
They
okay.
The judge in who ruled that there would be a trial, he denied the defense motion, and they did that by saying that the judge had probable cause.
Yeah.
They found probable cause. So this is what's, and it's gone back and forth, this whole idea, if somebody can be held responsible for those texts. And, of course, this is a bench trial. There is not a jury trial here. It's a bench trial, and one reason why the defense will often go to a bench trial is because they have a defendant who is so unattractive and unappealing. Here you have a pretty girl who is written some very ugly text.
Mm. David, stand by here for just a second. That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. I want to bring in Judge Nancy Gertner. She's WBUR's legal analyst and a retired federal judge. She's also a current professor at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, good to see you.
Nice to be here.
So respond to what David's saying about what we heard in court today. I mean, what does the law say? Does a person have to physically take action in order to be charged?
The problem is you're dealing with a statute which is an old common law statute, so it's an old statute. So all it says is that essentially someone who doesn't intend to kill, but winds up acting with wanton and reckless disregard of the consequences, winds up with involuntary manslaughter. So you're using sort of language from, you know, 200 years ago and trying to pour content into it.
Right. I mean, because to my mind, when I hear that statute, it brings to mind, you know, involuntary vehicular manslaughter, for example, like with a car. But here we're talking about words.
Right. And there's no question that this is an unusual case. The previous cases in this Commonwealth were, for example, the Russian roulette case. Everybody is participating in Russian roulette. One person dies, the other two are charged. Or the husband who gave his wife, the wife said she wants to commit suicide, he gives her the gun. Usually there are acts involved, and the court had to say in this case that these are words that are at such proximity to his act as to comprise involuntary manslaughter. It's not unusual that words are used either to show that you aided and abetted something, or words are used to show that you encouraged. The critical thing here will be causation. In other words, proving the relationship between her words and his acts when there were multiple efforts to try to commit suicide in the past.
David, jump in.
No, that's right. It's all about cause. Did she cause him to do this? Now, the extraordinary thing is that she's 30 miles away and texting. She did not see him for over a year. She's only actually physically seen him two or three times since 2012 when their families were vacationing in Florida and they met. So it's all about cause in these messages. He had a long history that she has also a troubled history. And so they're talking about ways to kill yourself, but she's also talking to him about joining her at McLean's Hospital, the psychiatric hospital, that he can get help. And the defense is showing that, in fact, she wasn't there, didn't put him in the car, didn't push him to do this, that he did it himself. They also have one text in which he says, "We should be like Romeo and Juliet at the end." Mm. You know how that you know what happened at the end? He texts, and she says, "Oh, yeah, expletive, no, we're not dying." So the defense is actually, it seems to be strong. It's made some strong points. They're bringing in a doctor who's going to be arguing that the antidepressants that she was taking caused her to be inebriated for a long periods of time, namely days.
Right.
And bearing in mind, this is going to be a beyond a reasonable doubt. A judge is going to have to make a determination right. of cause beyond a reasonable doubt here, which...
Judge Nancy, excuse me. I beg your pardon, Your Honor. It strikes me Robert Cordy, in his SJC decision upholding the judge, says that there was probable cause to show, and here I'm quoting, coercive quality of the defendant's verbal conduct overwhelmed whatever willpower the 18-year-old victim had to cope with depression. Those are strong words, yeah. Your Honor.
Right. But what he's saying, I mean, he's doing it in the context of a very unusual motion, which is a motion to dismiss charges that a grand jury had promulgated. So he's saying there's enough evidence that the government could show X, but that doesn't mean that X is what a judge will show when the other side is brought out. I agree with you. And in addition, at this point in the stage in the proceeding, he's taking the evidence in one sense most favorable to the government. That's what he has to do to be a screen, a gatekeeper. The judge is doing that to be a gatekeeper at this stage of the proceeding. So it is strong words, but it is one inference from the facts, and arguably there are other inferences. He's saying there's enough here to proceed.
Well, David, I'm just going to jump in here because you are on the phone with us because you're driving back to the WBR studios from court today, and I want to let you get back here so you can file your story for this evening and this afternoon. So David Bowery, WBR senior reporter, thank you so much, David.
You're welcome.
Judge Gertner, let me turn back to you because I got a couple more questions about this case before we move to other legal matters of the day. I mean, there was a defense appeal brief where Carter's attorney wrote that charging her with manslaughter was a transparent effort calculated to circumvent the fact that the legislature has not criminalized words that encourage suicide. I mean, that gets back to the question of the statute, but what's your response to that?
Well, it is true that in other states, there are statutes dealing with assisting suicide, expressly dealing with circumstances where someone either affirmatively assists suicide, like the guy giving his wife a gun, or fails to prevent under circumstances when you know a suicide will take place. But that's not a persuasive argument when you say if what you've done is covered by an old common law statute, but it's covered by that, the fact that the legislature didn't update it is really not a defense.
Well, I guess what I'm drawing is to this phrase that the legislature has not criminalized words. I mean, perhaps this is just too pedestrian of an interpretation, but can't the defense also just say, like, she has freedom to say virtually whatever she wants over text? The crime?
But it's an illusion to say we haven't criminalized words, right? I mean, if I threaten
these specific words.
Right, if I threaten you and I say, you know, you're not going to see your kids again, or I say I'm going to, you know, do something to you, those are threats that produce a result. And so arguably, you're not criminalizing the words per se, you're criminalizing the impact that the words had on the victim in this case. That's it. And that gets back to causation. How did the words play out, given their relationship, given their ages? She's 17, he's 18?
At the time, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Given their ages, you know, there's a whole other discussion about what texting does to language. In other words, whether or not people say things in that medium that they otherwise wouldn't say, and whether or not the recipient of the information knows that there's that kind of hyperbole going on.
I mean, so as David pointed out, this is a bench trial. There's no jury here.
Right.
So it's a judge that's going to be making these the decision. I mean, what would be the questions in your mind? How would you get to the bottom of this?
Well, I'd want to know something about the young man, about how many times he tried to commit suicide. What were the circumstances? Apparently, he had tried once before. I'd want to understand something. Apparently, he was also taking some medication that made him more suicidal, that it was correlated with suicidal ideation. I'd want to understand their relationship. And since it does require wanton disregard of the consequences, the question is whether this 17-year-old girl fully appreciated what she was doing. Now, in addition, the Cordy decision talks about her deleting text messages and things that suggested she had some understanding of what it was that she was doing. But it's a complicated case.
Yeah, I mean, one wonders because of the frequency of the texts and the interactions, the specificity of the things that were written in those text messages. I mean, we'll have to see how this case proceeds.
It's a difficult decision, and the judge is going to have a hard time making it.
Okay. Well, Judge Gertner, since you're here, can I ask you about something else that's coming up on the horizon in the world of legal eagles, if I can say? Oh, my gosh. Live radio, everyone. I'm so sorry. But this is a serious issue because former FBI Director James Comey is going to testify on Thursday. He's expected to do so. And there's obviously lots of questions swirling around his testimony. But one thing that you and I have talked about before, and you wanted to help us understand a little bit more, is this question of obstruction of justice, right? And whether or not it can be proved, or even it should be attempted to be proved, if there was any obstruction of justice to the DOJ's and the FBI's investigation into Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. I mean, why did you want to talk about this again?
Well, it's interesting. Words are involved here again. Oftentimes, threats are conveyed by words. It's not enough to say words are involved. So this is a statute. This would be brought under a statute that deals with corruptly or by threats, obstructs, impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the administration of justice. So the question is, I can't find another case because there's not another defendant or putative defendant like the president of the United States.
So in this case, just to be specific, the potential obstruction might be the firing of James Comey?
Well, the most likely obstruction of justice point, the thing that really triggered this discussion, was the comment that he said, "I hope you can let this go," when he apparently asked officers, other cabinet members to leave the room, and he says to Comey, "I hope you could let this go."
The investigation of Michael Flynn.
That's right. Now, if I said that to the chief of police, he would guffaw. So the question is, words coming out of the mouth of the chief executive officer of the United States to a subordinate that he can hire and fire, has a different resonance. And the question then becomes, what was the president's intent in saying that in the circumstances that he did? The other evidence, if there's any other evidence? That language alone probably wouldn't be enough, but what else is going on?
But did the president telegraph his intent? Because remember, the New York Times a couple of weeks ago reported that on a May 10th meeting that the president had with Russian officials, the foreign secretary and the U.S. ambassador, or the Russian ambassador to the United States, in the Oval Office, the president said to them, quote, "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy, a real nut job. I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off."
Right. So the issue is, what are the sort of acts and words that are in the box of obstruction of justice? One is the comment about Flynn. One is certainly firing Comey. He had a right to fire Comey, no question about it. But I may have a right, for example, to pay someone's rent who's a witness against me. It may be legal, but it certainly could be part of my effort to obstruct an investigation. So the fact that firing Comey is legal doesn't necessarily mean it didn't fit into a larger plot. The other question is, what else are we going to find here? I mean, everyone is sort of breathlessly stopping and saying, what do we have? What are we going to find? What records will be made or gone? What other comments were made to officials? Is this enough to begin an investigation of obstruction of justice? Yes. Is this enough to convict on obstruction of justice? Probably not. But certainly enough to begin.
Uh-huh. Okay, so take me. So I want to go back to what you're saying about the uniqueness of the president of the United States being at the heart of this matter. I mean, is there any case law that provides guidance in terms of, you know, what bar has to be crossed to prove obstruction in the case of the president?
Well, no, because in other words, the president's words have a different resonance.
Right.
So when he says, "I hope you lay off Flynn," and says it after he's excused people from the room to the person that he has the ability to hire and fire, then you are getting, and if he's doing so for the purposes of ending the Flynn investigation, in other words, for a corrupt purpose, not because he gives a damn about Flynn as a, you know, as a wonderful guy, but because he basically wants to put the kibosh on the investigation of Russian collusion, if he's doing it corruptly in the context of other things, yes, it could be obstruction of justice. We don't find a case with a president because his words have a different resonance than anybody else. There's a sheriff that was just convicted of obstruction of justice who, you know, basically talked to his cohorts about what the investigation was doing, suggested that they hide their informant, much more affirmative acts.
Yeah.
But the president doesn't have to take affirmative acts to accomplish the same thing with corrupt intent.
I just want to ask you a quick question about Comey himself, because we talked about this before, but now we know he's scheduled to testify both publicly and privately on Thursday. Do you think he should be publicly testifying at all? Could anything he says on Thursday have an impact on the DOJ's ongoing investigations?
It can. I can only assume that Bob Mueller and he have talked about what the appropriate boundaries of this are. And I have no idea what that would be. But I assume Mueller is a very professional prosecutor. I can't imagine that he would let him go ahead and if it really cast out on the rest of the investigation. But let's pause for a moment. I like to think of the Comey situation as when a woman would come to me claiming sex discrimination, and I would listen to her, and she's on the job, and I would say, you know what you should do? I figure it's only a question of time before you're going to be fired. Take notes. Take very good notes. Make sure you show the notes to your friend as they are contemporaneously generated. That's what Comey did. I think the issue here is going to be, what do his notes reflect of the myriad interactions he had with the president? And that may be where the obstruction of justice lay.
Wow. Which we can only find out either through leaks or if what the investigation itself determines is ever made public, which could be years down the line.
Right. That's true.
Well, Judge Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst, and she's a retired federal judge for the District of Massachusetts and currently a Harvard Law School professor. Always invigorating to speak with you, Judge Gertner. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, all day today, you've been hearing about a leaked top-secret National Security Agency document analyzing a Russian military intelligence cyber attack on a U.S. voting software company. The existence of the NSA's analysis was reported by The Intercept. And then there's also this other simultaneous story that the alleged leaker, an NSA contractor, has been arrested. Well, let's get reaction from someone close to the NSA, Joel Brenner. He's former Inspector General of the National Security Agency and former head of U.S. Counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He's now a senior research fellow at the MIT Center for International Studies. Joel Brenner, it's great to have you back.
I'm pleased to be back with you.
Well, so first of all, give us your reaction to what The Intercept reported, that the NSA had this analysis of Russian military intelligence targeting a U.S. voting software company.
Well, it's hard to know where to begin. I mean, what we've seen extraordinary naivete, as well as yet another example of the government's employees' inability to keep secrets. Let me start with the last one. We have a system now in which we clear tens of thousands of people at a very high level of clearance and have access to secret and top secret information. And we're putting that through a system that just wasn't built to handle that kind of volume. Mm. And it's breaking down. I don't want to speculate on why this particular contractor who had spent 6 years in the Air Force with high security clearances, why she did it. Maybe it was politically motivated. I don't know. But it was extraordinarily foolish of her. Her name was Reality Winner. It was extraordinary. She didn't realize how quickly she could be discovered.
Right.
And I think this was the easiest counterintelligence investigation in the history of the Republic. I mean, it must have taken them 15 minutes to figure out who did it. They looked at who had access to this particular document online. They looked at, it's been reported that they looked at who printed it out.
Mm-hmm.
And bang.
Yeah.
And then you had...
Well, and then apparently that she emailed The Intercept, allegedly, from her computer at work as well.
Yeah, it's this is not behavior of somebody who's careful or sly, you know.
But Joel Brennan, let me get back to what you were saying earlier. I mean, she's an NSA she's the alleged leaker, but an NSA contractor. And as you were saying, there are tens of thousands of people who have high-level security clearance to this very sensitive information from the NSA. I mean, are we letting too many contractors too close to information of high national security value?
Well, you know, you say contractors, but it's not a problem that's restricted to contractors, although I think, we couldn't function without them, frankly. The intelligence services couldn't function without contractor support. It's just a fact. And I think we're going to have to rethink not only what we classify, but how we protect it. And we don't. Another thing we don't do, Meghna, is we have a clearance system that looks at people on the way in. You know, when they give you a clearance, and then nobody really does much to monitor behavior until you maybe get a polygraph again 5 or 6 or 7 years later. Our system is not realistic that way. We don't look at behavior on a systematic basis while people are cleared. And of course, that's an invasion of privacy. But one gives up one's invasion of privacy. One gives up a substantial part of privacy to take these jobs.
Right. I was going to say one would expect that comes with the territory when you're working for the NSA, for example.
It
certainly
does.
I mean, but what you're describing seems to be a very large. I don't know what you call it—a problem, a loophole, a blind spot in terms of our control of sensitive information.
We also have people. There's so many people that we can't expect to have the same tight cadre of culture of secrecy when you expand it that fast. I mean, it's one thing you think of. The operations people at CIA, for example, we don't see leaks out of a place like that. Now, those are people who live and die, and whose sources live and die by their ability to keep their mouths shut. But we now have thousands of military people who are in the service for a short period of time. They're not committed to the intelligence business. They're just supporting it, for instance. And we have contractors who we've had some trouble with. On the other hand, we have some very good contractors, very trustworthy contractors.
Yeah.
So I think part of what we're going to have to do is to build a system that looks at behavior during employment, and partly we're going to have to think about how to make this a tighter business, classifying less and being more intent on secrecy of what we do classify. That's to say we overclassify it to some degree.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, I don't say this was overclassified. I mean, you know, the public doesn't need to know exactly how NSA figured out that the Russians had attacked our voting systems, and they don't need to know when they learned it, which would be very important to know if you were Russians.
Joel Brenner, let me just jump in here for a second, because I do want to get in the perspective from the administration itself, because in his daily White House press briefing, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer spoke about the leak from the NSA, and he was asked if the president had any reaction to the arrest of the alleged leaker, and here's what Spicer said.
I think that you've heard the president very clearly talk about the concern that he has about unauthorized disclosures of classified and sensitive information and the threat that they can pose to national security. So while I don't want to comment on any specific case or allegation, I think it is important to note that any disclosure of classified or sensitive information can clearly threaten our national security.
Joel Brenner, I heard you a little bit earlier having some very specific prescriptions for the NSA about, you know, tightening up its ship to make these to reduce the probability of these leaks. But I want to also talk to you about the first half of this story, which is the nature of what was leaked itself and the fact that the NSA seems to have had analysis showing that the Russian military was behind this spear phishing attack of a U.S. software company that handles, you know, voting software. I mean, the last time we had you on, it was talking about cybersecurity, and this seems like people's Exhibit A about the vulnerabilities we have.
Right. It was reported before that the Russian military intelligence, called the GRU, was involved in this. But let me come to the security of voting machines. I do not know a single qualified cybersecurity expert who thinks that electronic voting is secure. I'll say it again. It's not secure. And particularly insecure are a number of systems that do exist that do not even have paper backups for voting tallies. That's irresponsible. I mean,
Joel Brenner, I'm going to jump in here because you're putting a chill is running down my spine right now to hear the former Inspector General of the NSA say, "Hey, there are no secure electronic voting systems out there. We don't even need the Russians to do a spear phishing attack on these companies." I mean, what does that mean for, can we trust our elections, Joel Brenner?
Well, at this point, I think there's been no reason to distrust election results so far. I don't want to get carried away there. What I am saying is that it is possible to monkey with these systems in a number of ways. One way is you can go out and buy one of these machines, understand how it works, and then thereby understand how to make it not work, how to make it break. You can get into these systems through a phishing attack. I mean, think about if you and I were to set out to corrupt an election, what would we want to do? Well, we might want to change votes on voting days, but we might also want to change absentee ballots, which can be submitted in some places electronically. We might want to change registration rolls. We might want to contest counts. If we could, for example, steal the credentials of an election official, think of what you could do from an official system, not from a spoofed spoofed site, but from the real site. You could issue polling changes on election day.
Do we have any reason to believe that the Russians didn't do these things, though?
We have some indication that they tried to do most of these things. They were certainly trying to get into machines in ways that would allow them to do these things, not only through phishing attacks, but from, I think, stolen credentials. Which would be the real, I think, the brass ring to grab. If you have stolen credentials, my goodness, you don't have to do a phishing attack. You can, if I have your credentials, I can get into your system and issue things as if they're coming from you, and they would be coming from your account. That's the ball game here, and that's what why I say that these systems, as they're fundamentally insecure, some more than others, but. Americans have to realize that seamless convenience comes at a price. And the results of our elections, federal, state, and local, are what make our republic work. And to insist on seamless convenience as opposed to polling in the old-fashioned way just doesn't look smart to me.
Joel Brenner, let me ask you a question. Last time we had you on, you talked about the most vulnerable areas of our infrastructure that you think should be taken off the public internet, for example. I wonder if now, we just got a minute here to go, if voting should be considered one of those things. It's a vulnerable part of our civic infrastructure. Problem being, of course, it's run entirely at the local level. But is there anything that we can do to protect it?
Well, there are, you know, this is an answer that have to be addressed by a technical person to each particular system. But yes, they could be protected to some degree. But fundamentally, systems that do not have paper backups ought not to be allowed. Systems that do have paper backups, I think, have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Mm. But there ought to be a clear line. Without paper backups, the voting arrangements are not reliable.
Well, just to remind everyone, there are paper ballots here in the state of Massachusetts. Joel Brenner, former Inspector General for the National Security Agency, former head of U.S. Counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and current Senior Research Fellow at the MIT Center for International Studies. Thank you so very much for your insight today.
Great to talk to you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.